Let's make a start on Shir number 9. Last time in Shir number 8 we looked at the issue of the Mishnah and how the Mishnah came about, not overnight, but how it evolved, beginning with Hillel and Shammai, with what we saw was the Mishnah of Shona, beginnings of the structure of the Mishnah. We went through the process of Kerem B'Yavna after the Churban, and how they managed to have all the political wranglings there with Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Gamliel, and how emerging from that was Rabbi Akiva, who really put down the Matbeot. We saw a very important source last week, which says that Rabbi Akiva turned the oral law into Matbeot, into coined phrases, so that it became a fixed text. And eventually Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, in the generation or two after Rabbi Akiva, he put the final touches to what we now call the Mishnah. 6 volumes of the absolute condensed, crystallized Torah Shebaal Peh, meaning they whittled it down into, they concentrated it into the most concentrated form that they could in order to protect it, in order to stop it from getting lost. Because don't forget, they're in a post-Churban reality. It's no longer the world it used to be. They needed a new system, a new paradigm. But they wanted to keep as much of it oral as they could, so that you don't just go to a shelf and pull off a book and say, ah, this is Judaism. You still need a Rebbe, you still need someone to teach you the methodology as to how this system works. So when you learn Mishnayot, which I'm sure many of you have, and many of you will, when you learn Mishnayot, they're very terse, they're very concentrated and without a lot of explanation. They often don't make much sense. There's wording which seems to be missing, which needs to be filled in. It's not missing by accident, it's missing on purpose, in order for you to be able to have to fill in the gaps, etc. Over the 300 years after the Mishnah, the Mishnah somehow expanded into a much, much bigger book, which we call the Gemara or the Talmud. Really, Gemara and Talmud are pretty interchangeable. For various historical reasons, we stopped calling it Talmud at a certain stage. The church got very particular about us using the word Talmud. We started calling it Gemara. They are effectively the same thing for our purposes. Today, in today's world, it tends to be in yeshivas you learn Gemara, and in university you study Talmud. But for all intents and purposes, they are, for our discussion, the same. I want to look at 3 things today. I want to look at how that shift happened, meaning how they moved from a place of Mishnah to a place of Gemara, and why it happened. I want to look at how they were allowed to do any of this in the first place. We saw last week a source saying they weren't meant to crystallize Torah Shebaal Peh. It was meant to remain oral, for all of the reasons that we wanted it to, for stability and connectedness, etc. Why were they suddenly allowed to overturn thousands of years of halachic practice and then make a text, which we have today? And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, I want to look at why the Talmud was sealed, why it was finished, why it put an end to any more halachic discussion, innovation of that kind, meaning what we have now is analysis, we have interpretation, we have application of the Talmud, but we never had another Talmud. We have drawn a line under the Talmud that we have, and Rashi never thought, well, you know, it's a few hundred years since the last one, let's put together another Talmud. Don't forget, it was much longer from the Talmud to Rashi than from the Mishnah to the Talmud. So if they could put together a Talmud after a few hundred years of the Mishnah, why not another few hundred years after that? Why didn't the Rambam write his own Talmud? The Shulchan Aruch writes his own Talmud, and why didn't we write one in the 20th century? Couldn't we do with a little bit of a freshening up of the halachic process? Why don't we have a new Talmud today? That's a very important question, and of course that goes to the root of one of the differences between Orthodox and conservative approaches to Judaism, which we'll talk about at the end. So those are the 3 questions I want to look at today. How the Mishnah turned into the Talmud, number 1, why we were allowed to do it, and why the Talmud was never repeated up until today. So let's have a look at the source sheet, please. Let's start with the first question, source number 1. There is a source, Gemara in Bava Metzia, which says the following. Number 1, Tan Rabbana, Ha'oiskin B'Mikra. It's a very interesting source. Somebody who decides they want to learn Mikra, which is Chumash, Tanakh. Mida, that's a good measure. Ve'enu Mida, but it's not such a good measure. Meaning, don't focus all your time on learning Chumash, that's not the key study anymore. B'Mishnah, if you want to learn Mishnah, Mida, that's a good measure. V'not nilala haskar, and you get a good reward for that. That's a good thing to do. But Talmud, but if you want to learn Talmud, there's nothing better than Talmud. Okay? Ula Olam, but in all situations, have a rats the Mishnah yourself. Always run more to the Mishnah. So the Gemara asks, one second, that's a contradiction. You've just contradicted yourself in one line. Hagufa kasha, that itself is an inbuilt contradiction. Amrat, you said on the one hand, the Talmud, there's nothing better than Talmud. Vahada Amad, and then you just said after that straight away, La Olam have a Ratzla Mishnah, go tell me that Talmud, go to Mishnah more than Talmud, make up your mind, which is it? Is it Mishnah that's the most appropriate thing to learn, or is it Talmud? You can't have it both ways. So the Gemara says what will for us be a key to open this question. Amar Rabbi Yochanan replied, B'yemei Rebbe Mishnet Mishnah Zoh. This teaching was said in the time of Rebbe. Who's Rebbe? Rebbe is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the one who put together the final version of the Mishnah, he taught this particular teaching. Why? Shaf kukula alma masnisin. Everybody suddenly stopped doing matnisin, which is Mishnah. People left Mishnah. They said, that's it, it's done, it's finished. The Azu, and they turned instead back to Talmud, to the process of Talmud, which we'll see what that is. Meaning something, gear shifted, something changed gear. That they stopped doing whatever was Mishnah, and they started doing Talmud. Hadadarash Lahu, and said they have to come along and tell them, La'olam have a rap to Mishnah Yosef in a Talmud. Don't leave Mishnah too much. Don't get so excited by Talmud that you stop Mishnah altogether. Meaning people were so into the Talmud enterprise, Mishnah was beginning to be a little bit sidelined. So they came along and said, very nice, you're learning Talmud, but don't dissociate yourself completely from Mishnah. Why was it they suddenly started going to Talmud? And what is Talmud? And why was it they stopped learning Mishnah to the point that they had to tell them, don't stop too much, please make sure that you keep learning Mishnah. So, in the Gemara it says, on Rav Ashi and Ravina, who put the final Talmud together, in around the year 500, 450, 500, that's a different discussion which I'm not getting into too much now. I gave you on the second page, which I'm not looking at now, but you can look at later, a historical context to the formation of the Talmud, these are the different layers of the Talmud, which I'm not going to look at now, maybe I'll mention it in a few minutes. But Ravina and Rav Ashi were the last generation who finished the Talmud. So look at what it says. Number two, Rav Ashi were Ravina's Sof Hora'ah. Ravina and Rav Ashi were the end of Hora'ah. What's Hora'ah?
Teaching,
ruling. They were the end of that ruling. Says Rashi, what does that mean? And here he's going to define Talmud. What is the Gemara? Sof Hora'ah. Sof Kol Ha'amurayim. As I think we all know, the Amoraim is the name that we give to the rabbis of the Gemara, as opposed to the Tanaim, which are the rabbis of the Mishnah. So they were the end of the Amoraim. Ad Yemeichem, up until their time, lo haita Gemara al haseder. There wasn't an organized Gemara. Ella, but rather, kashahaita sheila, when there was a question, nish'elet, but Tama Mishnah, people wanted to know, what does this Mishnah mean? What does that Mishnah mean? The Mishnah they had. They had a text, whether it was an oral or a written text that we talked about a little bit last time, but they had a text. When there was a question on the Mishnah, on the reason, the meaning of the Mishnah, the Bet HaMidrash, in the Bet HaMidrash, or maybe Sheila al Maaseh Hamora, maybe there was a question on something that came up, Halachic Shaila, Bedin Mamon, or Issa Beheter, or on a question of monetary law, or ritual law, whatever it was, Kol Echad Echad Omet Hamor, everyone would give his own reason. I think the Mishnah means this. No, I think the Mishnah might mean that. What about this? Everyone would have his own approach. Rav Ashi and Ravina Sidru Shmos Amoraim Shalif. So Rav Ashi and Ravina put together a new synthesized final analysis of all the opinions that came before them. V'kavu'al seda mesechtas, and then they fitted those opinions around the mesechtas. What are the mesechtas? So we know this from last week for the Mishnah. Rav Yehuda Hanasi, when he put together the final version of the Mishnah, it's divided into what we call Masechtas. Different volumes. You have Sedarim, six Sedarim, Shas, okay, not to be confused with the political party, okay, which doesn't stand for Shisha Sedarim, but Shomrei Svarat, that's a different thing, although I'm sure they like the fact that the name coincides because it sounds appropriate. But anyway, that's a side issue. When they finish Shas, they divide it into Masechtas. Okay, 60-something Masechtas. So Ravina Rav Ashi had all this information on analysis of the Mishnah. They decided to fit all of this information around the Mishnayot in the most appropriate place. Kol echod ve'echod etzel ha-Mishnah ru'uyah v'ashnuyala. Each one, I'm on the third line in the middle, each one next to the Mishnah that most fitted it. Ve'hikshu kushyas, and then Ravina Rav Ashi put together questions. Question, meaning the Gemara has a voice. I'm sure people in this room have learned Gemara. There is a narrator to the Gemara. Who's asking all the questions?
Who's raising all the issues? What about this? What about that? Have you thought of this Gemara? Have you thought of this question? Who is that voice? That is the voice of Rav Ashi and Ravina, of the narrator, what we call the Stam of the Gemara. If anyone is interested in the more academic analysis of Talmud study, I'm not going to call it Talmud because the more academic analysis, so they can go and speak to Professor Weiss Halivni. If you know Professor Weiss Halivni, one of the preeminent academic scholars on Talmudic. If you make an appointment, okay, so here you have an address, you know how to get there. So Professor Weiss Halivni is one of the, he's pretty much retired now, but he was one of the leading Talmudic scholars on analysis of Jewish studies of the Talmud. He has a theory which is that the silent voice, or the background voice of the Gemara, is a little bit later than Ravi and Rav Ashi. He has a whole sefer on this. There's a debate on that. I'm not getting into the nanotechnology of that debate. He's still teaching, and he lives in Wilson Towers here. I was fortunate enough to have lunch with him at some stage in the last year or so, and he has some interesting things to say, but I'm not getting into that now. Whether it was Ravina Rav Ashi, whether it was a little bit later, what he calls the Stamayim, that's not for now, but there is a voice giving all the questions, ins and outs and ups and downs of the Gemara, Sheyesh Lahashiv, which you have to answer these, Upirukim, and then it answers them, Sheruim Latarit, Heima Amuraim Sheimahem, them and the Amuraim that goes with them. In other words, the Gemara as finished is a synthesized work. It's not just a record, well, one day Abaya said this, and Rava said this, and Rav Papa replied this. Actually, when you learn Gemara, you sometimes find that two people are arguing with each other who lived hundreds of years apart from each other. Yes? And people, we know this, it's not just like, oh, no one ever thought of that. Absolutely not. This statement was popularized in the name of this person. This statement replied, this answer to this question was popularized in the name of this person. And when Rav Ashi and Ravina put it together, they synthesized the discussion and had it between these two people, even though these two people may never have met. Many of them obviously did meet. Abaya and Rava were teacher and student, and Abaya and Rava were colleagues, but not always the case. So they fixed it all together. The Kavu Kola Gemara, and they put all the Gemara together, Kagoyim, such as the following kinds of questions, Esvei, Mesvei, Yeraminhu, Hiboilu, these are all kinds of questions I'm not getting into now, the Gemara asks, types of issues, Batsirutsum Shalayim, and it gave all the relevant answers. Umasha Shira, Oysam Shalip, Neham, and whatever had been left over before them, they fixed it all together, so basically, Rav Ashi and Ravina put that together. And that was the end of Hurrah. And we'll talk about that at the end of the shiur. Why was that the end of Horah? So what you now have is a book, which is much, much bigger than the Mishnah, because it contains a lot of stuff in it. It has analysis. If you look briefly at the Rambam tells us in number 5, what is the purpose of the Gemara? What does it contain? So he talks in the first paragraph, I'm not going to get into that, as to how the Gemara was written. We've more or less dealt with that issue in Rashi. But if you look here, he says, where I've got the Echad Sheni Shlishi Ravi at the bottom of number 5, he says, V'kava Matarato by Arba Devarim. There are 4 real purposes to the Gemara. This is the Rambam in the beginning of his, in the Hakdama to the Mishnah. He says, Ha'echad, one main purpose is, Biur HaMishnah, explaining the Mishnah. And all the different ways of understanding the text of the Mishnah, if that wasn't answered explicitly in the Mishnah, which often it isn't. And the reasons for each one saying what they said against the other. Meaning, you might have a Mishnah which simply says, Rabbi Eliezer says X, but Rabbi Yeshua says Y. But it gives no background and explanation as to what are the underlying reasons for that. Says the Rambam, the Gemara is there to fill that in. Ubiru ha'tayin ha'tzadeket, and explains what is the most correct approach. V'zuhi ha'matarah ha'ikarit b'matrata. That is the main purpose of the Gemara. And that really is. The Gemara is a commentary on the Mishnah. Whenever you read the Gemara, you see first appears a Mishnah, and then appears at the beginning a commentary on that Mishnah in the Gemara. But that's not all. Vasheni, the second reason of the Gemara is psak halacha, meaning you can't paskin from the Mishnah. There's too much information not there. There's too much left oral. Remember what we said at the beginning. In fact, the Gemara has some very nasty things to say about people who try to paskin from the Mishnah. I once had a conversation with someone, it was a long time ago, who turns his lights on and off on Shabbat, he said. Okay? Because he's worried about being robbed. So I said to him, okay, I understand that, but you know, you can't turn your lights on and off on Shabbos. He says, what are you talking about? It's in the Mishnah, in Bamei Madlikin, it says, Hamachabe, it's Anem, it's Negoim, it's Nelistin, Patur. Okay? So, look, you know, it's a nice conversation. I didn't want to get into all of the ins and outs of it, but that's it's a load of nonsense. First of all, you can't paskin from the Mishnah. Second of all, patur doesn't mean it's mutar. It's not permitted. It's just patur. It means you're not chayva, not deraisa. It's the rabbanon. This is the rabbanon. And there's a million reasons why that statement doesn't add up halachically, but whatever, he did what he did. So you can't paskin from the Mishnah, but from the Gemara you can, if you know what you're doing. That's how Pesach worked. In our last year, in number 10, we will talk about the Shulchan Aruch and how the Shulchan Aruch was a revolution in Pesach. Because Pesach was not meant to be from a book. You're not meant to open up a book and, oh yes, do this, don't do that, do this. You're meant to have a global knowledge of the Gemara, of the whole Shas, and put together the Halakha from your global knowledge of Shas. And if you and I don't happen to have that global knowledge, so we'll ask someone who does. But you don't go to a 15th century art scroll equivalent or whatever, a quick guide to how to behave in halakha. That's not how halakha Pesach works. Or it didn't used to be, and maybe it is now, and we'll see how that happened. So the Gemara is Pesach halakha, kidivrei echad hachol kibshenechlikum mishna, according to which of the views are we going to paskin, this one or that one, or bepeirusha, or its explanation, or b'masha nirmud menu, anything that comes is learnt out of it, or b'masha doma ledivrei hamishna. The Gemara, by the way, is not always easy to paskin from. In fact, it's often not. It doesn't usually spoon feed you. It doesn't give you a machloket and then say, and the bottom line is, drum roll, the halacha is according to X. It doesn't usually do that. You have to work it out from your understanding of the sugya, which takes a long discussion, sugya being the discussion in place. For example, if you have two opinions quoted in the Mishnah, and the Gemara brings both opinions and then asks 20 questions on one opinion, but never asks anything on the other one. Which opinion do you feel the Gemara is most interested in ruling like? The one it asks 20 questions on, or the one it asks no questions on? The one it asks no questions on because it has no questions. On the other hand, maybe it's the one that it asked 20 questions on, because you wouldn't ask 20 questions on an opinion unless you were concerned with that opinion. So maybe the other one which it asked no questions on is irrelevant. And the one it asked 20 questions on is actually the one that we pass him like. He's just got some bothered by the questions which needs to be solved. It's not as easy as it seems to be at first sight. By the way, the reason the Gemara is difficult to learn is not because it's in Aramaic. First of all, the Gemara is not in Aramaic. Much of the Gemara is written in Hebrew. All of the brightness, we talk about what they are, and the Tanaic material, Tanaitic material, is all in Hebrew. There is obviously Aramaic in the Gemara, but you can pick that up quickly. The reason the Gemara is difficult to learn, yes, quite quickly. If you learn 300 words, key words in Aramaic, which is not that hard to do, you have access to most of the Gemara. That's not why it's hard. Why it's hard is because for every word it says, there are 10 or 15 words that it doesn't say. Which is why if you look at the Schottenstein art scroll Gemara, it looks very different from the Sonsino. Back in the day, there was a Sonsino, there still is a Sonsino translation of the Gemara. They just translate each word for word into English. You can open up the Sonsino, it makes no more sense than it does if you learn it in the Aramaic. Just to translate it into English doesn't help you at all. It's completely inscrutable because you need to fill in the gaps. The art scroll, when they made the Schottenstein Gemara. So why is it that for every page of the Hebrew text, it takes them 5 or 6 pages of the English text to explain it? Because they add in all of the questions and all of the explanation, etc. So the reason the Gemara is hard to learn is because of the methodology. The language is not the key. The methodology is the key. Anyway, so that's the second. Hashlishi, back in number 5. There were things that came up after the Mishnah, meaning the Mishnah was put together in 150-200. There are 300 or 400 years of halachic psak innovation that came after that. And they fitted all these new ideas that came up between the Mishnah and the Gemara to the relevant opinions. So they fixed what they fixed. The Hagazeras, any new decrees. Hatzakonas, any new institutions. Shinasu, which were made. Me'acha Rabbeinu HaKadosh, from the end of the Mishnah. Adzmano, until the Gemara. So that's the third thing, filling in the what's happened since the Mishnah. And the last thing, says the Rambam Vaharavi, the fourth purpose of the Mishnah is drashot. Drash. Drash could mean all sorts of things. Midrashim. Meaning, the Mishnah doesn't include the agadic midrashim. It's very, what they call in English, apodictic. do this, do that. Don't do this, don't do that. It doesn't have lots of stories in it. Occasionally a Maaseh comes in. The Gemara is full of Agadata. They put all that in. It's got advice, marital advice, business advice, medical advice. And by the way, a separate question is, do we follow the medical advice of the Gemara? It has all sorts of weird, wonderful suggestions to, made for the relevant ills and cures that it deals with. The Rambam very clearly says, under no circumstances follow the medical advice of the Gemara. Go to a physician in your own time. I don't think the Rambam will be happy for us to follow his medical advice, because he's teaching us 12th century medicine, not 21st century medicine. Although, actually, fascinatingly, if you learn the Rambam's medical texts, They often feel very relevant today, the way he suggests we eat and we sleep and we exercise and all sorts of things. Very fascinating. But at the end of the day, the Gemara includes all of this stuff as well, and is now the holistic work of the Jewish people. And it's very, very big.
I have to mention that in the Gemara, when
we
talk about Mordechai, it's Mordechai.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's fabulous.
There's no question that there were very advanced mathematics in those days. The question is, was there advanced science in other areas? There are scientific discussions in the Gemara, or are they scientific discussions, or are they really just parables for deeper metaphysical issues? For example, there seems to be a debate in the Gemara between the sages of the non-Jewish world, there's a Gemara in Psachim, Daf Tzadi, Tzadi Aleph around there, between the sages of the non-Jewish world and the sages of the Jewish world. The sages of the non-Jewish, they all ask the question, what happens to the sun at night when it disappears? So it says, the sages of the Jewish world say, well, it goes beyond the horizon, disappears outwards, and then goes back over the top, but you can't see it because it's blocked by the sphere, if you like, by the stars. It goes over the top, and then it comes back out again, and it comes round again the next day. Whereas the non-Jewish scholar, says the Gemara, say, no, it goes underneath the other side of the globe. When it disappears over the horizon, it's going to Australia and back, or they didn't know about Australia, whatever. And the Gemara debates this, and very fascinatingly, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi says, actually, on analysis, I think their opinion is more correct than our opinion. And the Gemara eventually goes with the view of the non-Jewish sages over the view of the Jewish sages. Which is interesting, because it raises the whole modern question as to if there are apparent conflicts between science and Torah and religion, etc. How does one balance those? That's not for now. Rav Hirsch talks about this topic. Others talk about this topic as well. Rabbi Slifkin wrote a number of quite controversial books about this a few years ago. If you read those, then you'll know his discussion on that, and other people have responded. Now, the Gemara ends up being very big. Go over the page to page 2, please. I'll give you a few quick facts that you might find interesting. The Gemara has 5,422 pages. The way it's printed today, for all sorts of historical reason, is that you end up with an aleph and a bet.
Yeah.
Here, just on page 2. You end up with the daf bet amud aleph and daf bet amud bet. It just happens you happen to have 2a, 2b, 3a, 3b. There's no reason for it to be printed that way. We'll talk about the printing of Gemara in a minute. But there are 5,422 pages. Therefore, if you learn 2 pages every day, which is what we call daf yomi, it takes around 7.5 years to finish the Gemara. The question is, can you really learn 2 pages of Gemara in an hour or two in a daf yomi shir? Certainly the person who's giving the shir, it's an incredible exercise because he's had to prepare it and give the shir. The people at the shir, so it depends on what else they're able to do. Some people prepare in advance and do chazara afterwards. Some people go to whatever they go to is fantastic. But it's a very much a quick whistle-stop tour through the Gemara. Think about this. If you go to a yeshiva and learn a Gemara be'ian, how long does it take you to cover 2 pages, to cover 1 daf of Gemara? You can be learning it 5-6 hours a day, and it'll take you months and months and months. And yet in daf yomi, you're whizzing through that in an hour. I sometimes think of daf yomi as the open top bus tour round Shas. Meaning, you go on as a tourist, you go to Prague, and you've never been to Prague before, so you've got a couple of days in Prague. So the first thing I do when I go, you go on those hop-on, hop-off, open-top buses, because I don't know anything about Prague, I have a map, but I want to get a bit of context. Let's go on the bus, let's sit on the top of the bus and drive around Prague, and tomorrow then I'll know a little bit where I'm going to go. So you know how it is, you sit on the bus and you put that thing in your ear that never works, and you try 3-4 plugs till you find one that works. And then they say, you know, on your right is the presidential palace, and everybody looks around, and by the time you look around, you've already turned around the corner, and everyone says, "Which is it, that one? Is it that one? Is it this one?" But you know something, it's better than nothing. Daphyomi's a bit like that. You're taking an open-top bus tour around the Shas. You never actually get off and go in anywhere. You just whiz past all these fascinating issues, so that one day, if you ever want to come back to the question on this or that, so you know where it is. You can go back and go in more detail, you can go in. It's a wonderful thing, Daphyomi. Again, most wonderful for the person giving the shiur. And now they have Daphyomi shiurim everywhere. It's an interesting comment on the way that Jewish society has developed. I read something recently that about a man was writing that his father, if his father would have gone to shul for anything extra back in the 40s, he'd have gone to say Tehillim maybe. These days, with men especially, they don't go to shul to say Tehillim so much. I mean, people do, there's nothing wrong with saying Tehillim. But people go to shul now to a shiur. It's very much a learning culture in a way that it wasn't. Rav Kook talks about this as well. He says, back in the day, the Gedolim were on a level that you could hardly imagine. They were the highest of the high. And the vast majority of people were completely ignorant. They really didn't have a clue. He says, what's happened, says Rav Kook, over the 18th, 19th century, is that the status, the standing, the level of the Gedolim has come right down, and the level of the Abalabatim has come right up. And therefore you see that there used to be the Amaratim or Amaratim Lemahadrim. Today, everyone's picked up a little bit here and there, which actually is a dangerous thing as well. But a lot of people go to Daphyomi. You can have women's Daphyomi shiur, women's Daphyomi shiur given by women, given by men. There's also, any way you want to cook it, there's a Daphyomi shiur for you. And therefore, the Gemara is definitely very worthwhile. Don't forget that the Gemara, not every Mishnah has Gemara on it. Meaning, when they put the Gemara together, and maybe I mentioned now that, of course, are two Gemaras. And one is very much the senior and one is the junior. There is, of course, what we call the Talmud Yerushalmi as well. This is having something of a renaissance as well. There is now Daphyomi in Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi, though, is much harder to learn because we're not used to the Aramaic as much and the methodology as much. And there's less of it and it's less polished, it's less edited and synthesized than the Gemara Bavli. But at the end of the day, there is Yerushalmi as well. But on the Bavli, they didn't write Bavli on all aspects of the Mishnah. For example, on the halachas of Tzluyus Baaretz, on the mitzvahs of Tzluyus Baaretz, Shmita, Trumas, Maasas, etc., there's no Gemara Bavli on the Masechtas of Shviyas, of Shmita, of Truma, of Maasas. There is Yerushalmi, but there's no Bavli. There is no Bavli on the Sukkis of Tuma and Tara, on Kalim, on Ohalot. They did do Nidah, because Nidah was still relevant. There is, however, interestingly, Bavli on Kochim, on the Korbanot. Why? Why would they take the time to put together a whole Gemara on Zvachim and Menachot and Bechorot, etc., when they're not applicable? So in the 5th century in Babel, so that's no more applicable than Shemitah is applicable. So why did they go to all the trouble to put together the Gemara on Kochim? So there are different theories about this, but one of the main theories is when it comes to Kochim, there is a benefit and a merit in learning the halachas of the Korbanos. There's an idea in Hashkafah that if you learn the halachas of Korbanos, it's as if you brought the Korban. There is no such thing as if you learn the halachas of Shemitah, it's as if you planted a Shemitah tree, or didn't plant a Shemitah tree, or whatever it is. So we have a lot of Gemara on Kochim as well, and between the two, between all of the Yerushalmi and the Bavli, we have pretty much most of it covered. Have a look in number 6. My Bavel. Why is Bavel called Bavel? Interesting question. Why is Bavel called? Where did the word Bavel come from in the Chumash? Bilbulu et lashonot. Bilbulu, it's a big mixture. Okay. I once asked somebody, that's very nice, not a very nice name, why would the Babylonians call Bavel Bavel? We call Bavel Bavel because it's all a big mix-up. Why do they call Bavel Bavel? They also call it Babylonia. So he said, it's Pashut, Bab-El. It's the gate to God. So in other words, the word Bab-El has different connotations depending on how you want to read it. But we said number 6, my Bab-El, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Blula B'mikra. It's all mixed up with Chumash, Blula B'mishnah, it's mixed up with Mishnah, Blula B'talmud. It's mixed up with Talmud, it's all mixed up together. And in fact, learning the Bavli can be a very frustrating exercise. So it quotes the Pasuk in Eicha, V'machashakim hoshiveini kemeisei olam. You've led me through the dark places, says the Gemara. I'm Rabbi Yirmiyahu. Zeh Talmud shel Bavli. Shel Bavel. It's a difficult limud. Right, Eichayashva Badad, you're on your own. It's all very difficult. Look at Tosfos, says number 7. Blula b'mikra b'mishneh. Perush Rabbeinu Tam. The Rabbeinu Tam explains the Batalmud shelanu. We have an idea in learning that we should be learning all of that. We should have a mixed diet in learning. The Chachamim said, "La'olam yishalish adam shenoisav." A person should divide his time into three: shlish b'mikra, a third in mikra; shlish b'mishnah, a third in mishnah; and shlish b'shas, a third in the analysis of the mishnah. Afal pike, nevertheless, we do this. We read the Kol Yom Parshat Tamid in the morning. We read something from the Chumash. The Shonim the Mishnah Eidim Wakomam. We read the Mishnah Azel, and then we read Rabbi Yishmael Omer, which is from the Gemara, from the Sifra, obviously. But he says, actually, we don't need to because learning Talmud has all of them. Think about it. When you learn Talmud, you're learning Chumash, there are Pesukim in there. You're learning Mishnah. You're learning Gemara. And that's one of the reasons why Talmud became the preeminent study in the world of yeshivas. You know, there's an old joke that the two yeshiva guys find the Chumash lying on the shelves, and they say, "Oh, look at this! This is a collection of all the psukim mentioned in the Gemara." So, you know, it's a joke, but it's not so funny, because sometimes people are more focused on Gemara than Chumash. But at the end of the day, Gemara has everything in it that you would need. The Gemara, of course, was one of the first printed Sforim. Actually, the first printed Sefer was not a Gemara, but was, any guesses? A Chumash Rashi. The first Jewish book to be printed was a Chumash Rashi. In fact, when I was at university in Oxford many years ago, they had a library where they had original 16th century printed Chumash Rashis, which you could just take off the shelf and look at, really amazing things. But it wasn't very long before they actually printed up the Gemara. The print that we use of the Gemara today is what we call the Vilna Shas, because it was printed in the mid-19th century in Vilna by the widow and the brothers Rom, which was a family, they inherited the printing press. And now it's pretty much standardized that the version of the Gemara that we use is the layout of the Vilna Shas, to the point that if you produce a Gemara which doesn't have that layout, like Rabbi Steinsaltz did in his first edition of the Steinsaltz Gemara, everyone gets very upset. They got upset with him for other reasons as well. But one of the reasons was, ostensibly, that he changed the layout of the Shas. Think about it, people have a very visual image of the Gemara. It's thick here, and it's thin there, and it's big there. If you change that layout, it's a problem. But there were many Gemaras that didn't have that layout. For example, it's now become very standard the Gemara is printed with Rashi on one side, and Tosfos on the outside. That didn't have to be that way. They decided that those were the two things to print on the Gemara. There were those that were very opposed to that. The Maharal of Prague was very opposed to having Tosfos on the daf. He said it's too advanced a perush, a commentary, to have it on the page of the Gemara. It should be with the people at the back of the Gemara. Rashi is obvious. There was a Shas printed by Daniel Bomberg, the Bomberg Shas, became a very famous Shas. Daniel Bomberg, even though he sounds Jewish, he wasn't Jewish. He ran a printing press in Italy back in the 15th century. And he printed a Shas which was given to Henry VIII. Why does Henry VIII need a Shas? He's got enough time, got all his hands running the country and dealing with all his wives. He needed a shaft because he got into some difficult situations with his brother's wife. Henry VIII, without getting into a long discussion on this, Henry VIII was married off to his older brother Arthur's widow. And that became his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, who was, of course, the daughter of Isabella and Ferdinand of Spain. So anyway, he, at a certain point, didn't want to be married to her anymore because he had his eye on someone else. And therefore, he wanted to make a case that he was never allowed to marry her in the first place because it's incestuous to marry your brother's wife unless there's a yibum situation. And if there's a yibum situation, it's not, but he wanted to have the marriage annulled. So one of the things he did is he had people analyze the yibumus, the sugyas, and the Gemara, etc. And they donated a whole set of Gemara to Henry VIII, which for many, many years was in the possession of the British authorities and eventually found its way to the Church of England. For many years, because Henry VIII broke off and founded the Church of England, the Church of England held on to the Bomberg Shas. There was a very well-known antiquarian book, Jewish foreign collector in London, called Lunzer. okay? Henry Lunzer, I think. Was it Jack Lunzer? It was one of them. Mr. Lunzer wanted to put his hands on the Bomberg shafts for many, many years, and he approached the Church of England on many occasions, only to be told it's not for sale. He realised the only way he was going to get the Bomberg shaft is by offering the Church of England something they wanted even more than the Bomberg shaft, and somehow or other he got his hands on some incredible document. I think it was the original title deeds for Westminster Abbey or something like that, and he called up the church again and they said, look, Mr. Lunzer, we've had this conversation, we're not selling. And he says, no, I think you are selling, look what I've got. And they were overwhelmed by what he had to offer, and they gave him the Bomberg shaft and paid him, as far as I'm aware. And if you want to buy the Bomberg shaft, you can. It is now in Sotheby's in New York, waiting for a buyer with the rest of the Lunzer collection. I think it's around $130 million. But if you're looking for something to do with your spare cash, then and you're interested in making an investment that will appreciate, then that's something you ought to consider. I'm not, by the way, here to give you investment advice. So please ask someone else. I don't know. The one that was given to Henry VIII is called the Bomberg shaft. I doubt that he only printed one, but I don't know. The person to speak to on this issue is Rav Dovid Kamenetsky. Rav Dovid Kamenetsky, who lives in Arnav, is an absolute expert on these issues, and he was actually brought in by Sotheby's to be the editor of the collection, and he knows the Lunzer collection inside out. So he can tell you the stories better than me. Anyway, enough of that. So we have the Gemara. Now we have our own shaft, the Vilna shaft, printed recently. I want to move on to the question number is, why were we even allowed to do this? We know you're not allowed to make the oral law into a text, and now we have a text, and a written text at that, eventually. So have a look, please, on page 3. Turn to the top of page 3, and let's look at the second question. I just want to spend 5 minutes on this, and then spend the rest of the time on the third question. There is a pasuk in Tehillim called, it says as follows, Eis la'asos la'shem heferu suratecha, which on a basic shout level means, it is a time to act for God, they are breaking your Torah. Meaning, when you see people are breaking the Torah, you have to galvanize the troops, get people to act for God, it's time to... Yes, exactly. Eis la'asos la'shem heferu suratecha, they want to open a cinema on Shabbat down the road, so people say, oh, let's galvanize the troops, let's have a rally, let's have a whatever it is, and try and get that not to happen. Come along, Chazal, and say, you know something, there is a secondary reading to this, which turns it on its head. Number 9. The Omer, the Gemara in Brachos, says, Eis la'asos Hashem heferu suratecha. Rabbi Nosson, who was one of the main people putting the Mishnah together, the first major text, heferu suratecha, on the contrary, you must break the Torah, mishum eis la'asos Hashem. Because it's time to act for Hashem. Meaning, built into the halachic process, seems to be some kind of an emergency override button. Meaning, under certain circumstances, the leaders of the generation can turn around and say, because the time is demanded, we have to now override what was previously a Torah problem. Have a look at how the Gemara explains the number 10. Amar Reish Lakish, Pa'amim, she'bitlu ha'shel Torah, zehu yisoda. Sometimes breaking the Torah is actually upholding the Torah. Where do they get this from? Dichsiv asher shibarta. God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, pick up the luchot which you broke. Say Chazal, Amalai Kadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, Yashakaychecha asher shibarta. Asher shibarta, meaning there's not a hint of criticism that Moshe Rabbeinu smashed the luchot, although if you'd have asked anyone what was the appropriate thing to do, then smashing the luchot that we just received from Hashem was probably not one of the things that you would have suggested has been a good move straight after Matan Torah. And yet Moshe takes this on himself to smash the luchot. From there you see that sometimes breaking, literally in that case, breaking the Torah was what was needed in order to uphold the Torah. And if you look how the Rambam explains this in number 12, he says, V'chaynim ra'u l'fi sha'a. If they see, and it's not just you and me, it's the Sanhedrin or maybe a Navi, number 12 here, if they see on a temporary basis, l'batel mitzvah da'aseh, they have to cancel out a positive mitzvah, or la'avor al mitzvah slois da'aseh, or even break a negative mitzvah, in order to restore people to appropriate religious practice, or lahatil rabim Yisrael, or to save people in the Jewish people, melahachshil b'dvarim acherim, from stumbling on other issues. Oisid, they are allowed to do that, they're allowed to break the mitzvahs, lefi mashit tzricha hasha, according to whatever the time demands. Apart from avodah zarah. That's the one exception. Kishem shaharofe chotech yado or raglo shel zeh. Just like a doctor, because the Rambam knew this full well as a physician, sometimes has to amputate a hand or a leg, kidei sheyichye kulas, to save the individual whole, kach beisdin, similarly a beisdin, morim bizman min azmanim la'avor aksas mitzvahs, the beisdin can override from time to time mitzvot, lefisha on a temporary basis, kidei sheyitkaimu kulam, so that the whole system will be upheld, kiderech she'amru chachamim harishonim chaleil alav shabbat achad, kidei sheyishmo shabbatot harbeh. Which is interesting as to who has this authority and when can they use it. This is obviously a very dangerous weapon. We don't turn around and say this on every occasion. They don't turn around and say, well, you know something, better people should come to shul, even if they drive, so let's open up all the car parks. I mean, there are people that would say that, and there are Orthodox shuls with open car parks on Shabbat as well. Obviously, the rabbi is not saying you should drive, but the question is, why don't we say, Eitlas Os Lashem, look, better off the people should do this, to save the system as a whole. This seems to be an open door to a lot of reform of the halachic system, and we find it's only been used on a number of occasions in the past, usually to protect Torah. The Rambam in number 13 in his introduction to Morin Nevuchim, he says, I'm a bit embarrassed at the fact that I'm going to write this book. Who says I'm even allowed to write this book? The Morin Nevuchim, the guide for the perplexed. He's going to be revealing a lot of things which he considers to be very deep secrets and issues and how to understand Torah that have never really been set out before. And he says, my justification for this is Eit La'asos L'Hashem. Also that I'm L'Shem Shamayim, he says. If Eit La'asos L'Hashem, L'Shem Shamayim, I need to do this. The door needs it. Similarly, I brought you, and I'm not going to go through it in detail, there's quite a famous tshuva of the Sri Dei Esh, of Yechiel Weinberg, Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg. He has a tshuva on mixed singing of Zmirot on Shabbat. It's quite a famous tshuva. He wrote it after the war for youth groups that wanted to have, like Bnei Akiva type youth groups, that had boys and girls doing Shabbat programming together, and they asked him a question that all the boys and all the girls are getting into the Shabbat Ruach, and they're singing Zmirot together. Are we able to allow this? And he has a whole analysis based on, he says, you know, the minag in the Yekesha countries was that women did sing Zmirot, and there's this potential heter, and there's that potential heter. And at the end of the day, he says, look, all of the heterim are really pretty weak to allow this mixed singing on Shabbat. At the end of the day, he says, Eis La'asos L'Hashem, we are doing this because we have to, because we, in order to keep these kids connected with Jewish life and to give them Shabbat Ruach, etc., this is what we have to do. And it's not that we just made it up. There are leniences to rely on, but many, many times through that tshuva, he says, Eis La'asos L'Hashem. And this obviously is a big question in Kirov today. What are the lines, what are the boundaries that you have to draw in order to be appropriate and inappropriate things that you innovate for outreach work? And these are very carefully thought through, and they don't just turn around and say, Eis La'asos L'Hashem for everything. You know, let's all go down to nightclubs on Shabbat and find people to bring in for Shabbat dinner. You know, most people don't do that, but yes. L'chai Behem is really talking about Pikuach Nefesh. We're not talking about the Kuach, we're not people who are going to die. If someone's going to die, then it's easy, because we can break the halakha in order to save them. But this is more complicated. Even, by the way, you remind me, there's a shaila, very fascinating shaila, it's not really on topic, so I won't spend more than a minute on it. There was someone in the Middle Ages whose daughter was kidnapped on Shabbat by the church. And the church were going to take her away and bring her up as a nun in a convent. And the father had the opportunity on Shabbat to bribe the officials to get his daughter back. And the shaila was, is he allowed to break Shabbat in order to get his daughter back? Because if he leaves it till Sunday, it's all over, it's too late. And the interesting shaila was, it's not pikuach nefesh, because the daughter's life is not in any way endangered. And pikuach nefesh doesn't mean danger to the soul. Danger to the spirituality means physical danger. On the contrary, this girl probably will be better looked after and healthier growing up in the church. On the other hand, obviously, it's a complete devastation to her spiritual life to be brought up as a Christian. And the shaila was, is he allowed to break Shabbos to save his daughter's neshama? And actually, the answer he got to that tshuva was, no, he's not, surprisingly. And the Shulchan Aruch brings up this shaila and disagrees, and Paskin's like a different view, and says, yes, he is. He is allowed to break Shabbat. Not only is he allowed, he's obligated to break Shabbat. The question, but there is why? Because it's not pikuach nefesh. It must be something else. And without going into a whole analysis of that, it seems that there are sometimes justifications for breaking one mitzvah in order to save somebody from doing an even more serious avera, which is beyond what we can talk about today. But you reminded me when you said v'chai v'hem. Right. Sridei Eish, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. The Sridei Eish is one of the most fascinating individuals of the 20th century. He grew up in a Lithuanian background, but then ended up in Germany. And he became the head of the Hildesheimer Rabbiner Seminar in Berlin, and actually in the 1930s wanted to transplant that to Israel, and had permission to do that, but then it was nixed by various other people. If you're interested in reading a very interesting book about Rabbi Weinberg, then Mark Shapiro wrote many years ago, his first major book was a biography of Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg, as he's called, Between the Yeshiva World and Modern Orthodoxy, something like that. It's a very good read. It's a very interesting sefer. Now, let's look at the last question in the last 7 minutes of the shiur. Why did we never get another Gemara? We are number 15. Number 15, let us go on. Says Rav Shmuel HaNagid. Rav Shmuel HaNagid was effectively the Prime Minister of Spain in the early Middle Ages. He was Jewish, he wrote for him, and under the Islamic rule, the Jews, this was the golden age of Spain. He says the following. Trei shechibru ha-Talmud, Talmud, the two who put together, who finished writing the Talmud, or putting it together, maybe it wasn't written exactly then, heim Rav Ashi v'Ravinu, they are Rav Ashi and Ravinu, v'siatam, and those who assisted them, u'b'yameihem, and in their days, nechtam ha-Talmud, chatima, it was sealed, that was it was finished. Have a look in the Rimigash, in number 16, the Rimigash, a less well-known source, but he's important because he's the Rebbe of the Rambam's father, and therefore effectively of the Rambam. Look at number 16. V'zeh Talmud shelanu halacha l'maasehu. This Talmud of ours is the halacha l'maaseh. Shelo nichtav. Okay. El la'acha iyan. It was only written after great thought, for dikduk and great care. The Kamadoris over many generations, la'acha kamamadure, and over many editions. It wasn't just written overnight. Ukeilu amrulanu, as if they're saying to us, bo halacha l'maasehu. That in that book is the halacha l'maaseh shehari laso, it's bo maaseh kasbir. Whatever they want us to do, they wrote in there. Look over the page, please, number 4, page 4, number 17. I'm going to deal with a few of these a little bit more quickly. Ka'asha meisu kol ha-chachamim, says the Rambam, when all the rabbis died in the Amorim, she'achroni mehem, the last of them was Ravina Rabashi, u'kfar nishlam ha-talmud, the Talmud was finished. Harikol Misha Amud Acharav, and this is critical, anything that happens after the Talmud, Ein Matarasa, what is its purpose, its goal? Ela Havanat Divreihem Shechibru Bilvad. Only to try and work out what the Talmud says. Alav Ein Lahosif, we can't add to the Talmud, Umimeno Ein Ligroa, and we can't take away from the Talmud. He didn't yet say why, but he said we can't. That the Talmud is the bottom line. But, of course, it means that anything after the Talmud is no longer sealed. Look in number 18, and there are different opinions on this halachically, but the Ramah brings in Shulchan Aruch, Mihu Yesh Omrin. There is a view. De im nira le dayan, if it seems today to a judge, to a halachic posek, ule b'nei doro on his generation, mikoach rayot muchrachot, and they can bring proofs, and they can argue the case, she'ein adin kamoshe huzku b'poskim, that the din is different from what is previously mentioned in the poskim. Let's say someone in the 19th century disagrees with the psak in the 17th century, or in the 13th century. They can disagree. Absolutely. Yachol lachlok alav, they can disagree. Anyone can disagree with anyone. Ma'ach she'einu nitka gemara, as long as it's not in the gemara. Because the Gemara is the bottom line, but nothing after the Gemara. Now, how does this work? First of all, why is the Gemara the bottom line? And is it really the case that anyone can argue with anyone after the Gemara? So we'll see next time in the last year, we've got a few things to do left before the end of today, but we'll see next time that according to many people, there are other lines drawn in the sand. Meaning, we sometimes, according to some, can't go behind the Shulchan Aruch. But there are those, especially in the Ashkenazi world, that really hold this very much to heart. That the bottom line is the Gemara. Anyone can really argue with anyone. If you've got big enough guns to be able to blaze your trail, you can take on anyone as far back as the Gemara, but not the Gemara. Now, in practice, most people do not do that. There are strata even after the Gemara. The Achronim don't tend to disagree with the Rishonim. We'll talk about why that is next week. But in principle, that is not necessarily the case. But the Gemara is the bottom line. The question is, why is that? And there are three approaches, which I'll outline for you now. Why is it the Gemara is sealed? Approach number one, and I'm not going to go through all the sources, but at the bottom of page 4, I put F, why was the Talmud sealed? So one approach is Yeridas Hadoras. What is Yeridas Hadoras? There are many sources for Yeridas Hadoras, that the generations decline. Look for a second in number 21, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Okay, Liban Shal Rishonim Kepitzko Shel Ulam. The minds of the earlier generations were like the breadth of the opening of the gates of the Beit HaMikdash. V'shal Achronim Kepitzko Shel Heichal. But the later ones were narrower. Okay, V'anu Kemale Nekev Mechet. And we're just the opening of a needle. Meaning we're going down and down and down. An interesting and a slightly amusing source in number 23, Amar Rabbi Zera, Amar Rabba, Abra Ben Zimuna, Im Rishonim B'nei Malachim, if the original ones were like angels, Anu B'nei Anashim, we are like mere humans. V'im Rishonim B'nei Anashim, if they were like humans, Anu Kachamayrim, we're like donkeys. V'loike Chamorim Shal Rabbi Chanina Ben Doisev, Shal Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair, and we're not even like the donkeys of the Chachamim, because the donkeys have Seichel. And a kashar chamayim. We're like regular donkeys. Meaning, we don't get the idea coming from these sources that things are going up. Things are going down. And Rav Shura Gaon clearly says, source 24-25, clearly attributes the Gemara and the Mishnah being sealed to Yeridas Hadoras. After the Mishnah, they just didn't feel able to argue because they dropped. After the Gemara, they just didn't feel able to argue with the Mishnah because they dropped. The question on that approach is, well, what about after the Gemara? Why is there no Yeridas Hadoras, according to some? Why could we argue with people 400 years ago, 800 years ago, as long as we're not arguing with the Gemara, even though most people don't? Is there no more Yeridas Hadoras? And also within the Gemara, later authorities within the Gemara argue with earlier ones. Absolutely. And in the Mishnah, later people in the Mishnah argue with earlier ones. It's just that there are lines that seem to be drawn between certain strata. We don't always, therefore, find that the later people are unable to argue with the earlier ones. We don't find that. Therefore, the Rambam gives a very different answer. And he says as follows. I'm not going to look in all the sources, but I'll explain it to you. The Rambam, in source 26-27, explains, actually, source 27 really is the Rambam. He says, no, it wasn't Yeridas Hadoras. And by the way, it's not so clear that the Rambam even agrees with Yeridas Hadoras. 27, the big source, although I'm not going to take all your time to go through, but the Rambam gives a very practical reason. And he says as follows. After the Gemara was finished, the Jewish people ended up scattered across the planet. There were geopolitical realities. The Roman Empire had collapsed. The roads were impassable. There were Goths and Visigoths and Huns and all sorts of people who were not very friendly. And even though the Romans might have been brutal and sadistic on different levels, at least they kept things. They were civilized. They had the Pax Romana. You could get from one side of the Roman Empire to the other without worrying about highwaymen killing you on the way. After the Roman Empire collapsed, that was no longer the case. Says the Rambam, practical reasons meant that the Jewish people just couldn't get together again like they had. There was never another Gemara because we were just too far apart. And therefore, says the Rambam, nothing that ever was instituted after the Gemara has the authority to bind the Jewish people. If the Sfaradim, and the Sfaradim and the Ashkenazim we'll talk about next week as to how that split happened, if the Sfaradim decide to take on a new stringency, they're not going to eat fish with cheese. So that's not mentioned in the Gemara. And therefore the Ashkenazim can turn around to them and say, well, that's very nice for you, but that doesn't bind us. You can do your thing, we're not bound by that. And if the Ashkenazim decide on Pesach not to eat rice and beans, the Sfaradim can look at them and say, look, that's not in the Gemara. We are only bound by the Gemara. Because after the Gemara, nobody ever got together in the same numbers, in the same kind of unity to make another one. The question, according to the Rambam, is, I don't even know if it's about the knowledge, it's just about the practical ability to get together and do this. The question, of course, with the Rambam is, well, what about today? What about today when people come back to Eretz Yisrael, when everyone's connected, everyone can just pick up this and speak to anyone in the world pretty much within a second through a piece of plastic. Everybody's a next door neighbor to everybody. How does this still apply? That's a good question which we'll talk about another time. But that's the Rambam's approach. It's not so much Yeridus HaDoros. And the last approach, which is a more mystical approach, which I'll leave you to think about, is there is an idea of the 2,000 years of Torah. There's a Gemara which talks about this idea that there are 6,000 years of this world, 2,000 years of Tohu Vavohu, pre-Torah, 2,000 years of Torah, and 2,000 years of Mashiach, meaning this is potential for Mashiach. If you look at those numbers, you'll see the 2,000 years of pre-Torah is from Adam HaRishon to Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu introduces the 2,000 years of Torah. He explains Torah to the world, which includes Har Sinai and the Jewish people, the Beit HaMikdash, and the 2,000 years of Torah basically expire at the end of the Mishnah. That's basically when they expire. And then the rest of the time is post-Torah, post the download, if you like, of Torah. So there are ideas that that's the reason why there's a line drawn at that stage, but there are questions on that as well, and I've brought you sources at the end. One way or the other, and we'll finish with this, the Gemara is sealed. And that is one of the major debates and disagreements between the conservative and the Orthodox world. The conservative world, when they broke off from the Reform world, said, look, we're not prepared to accept the sealing of the Gemara, and we'll argue with the Gemara. The Orthodox world says, no, that is, Rambam never had the chutzpah to argue with the Gemara, Rashi never did that. That's not something we can do until, once again, there is a Sanhedrin which establishes a new authority in Klal Yisrael, which there could be, and there could be soon, but for now we don't have that, and therefore we have the Gemara. Next time, which hopefully is 2 weeks from today, I said at the beginning there's no show next Tuesday, but hopefully 2 weeks from today, there will be the final installment which will deal with the halachic process since the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, and the controversy of the Shulchan Aruch, and we'll finish with that. And again, just to remind you that next Wednesday, even though I'm not giving a show next Tuesday, next Wednesday, in the beginning of the Elul program, I will be starting Be'ezrat Hashem, a new series, on Wednesdays at 10:15, dealing, nothing to do with this topic, dealing with halachic and hashkafic foundations of mitzvahs bein Adam l'chaveru. And we're going to look at lots of very interesting mitzvahs bein Adam l'chaveru, and hopefully we will we'll have lots to say on that too. Alright, have a lovely week.